tennis fans are buzzing about Serena Williams' obscenity-laced tirade at the U.S. Open semifinals on Saturday. It reminded a lot of people of John McEnroe's angry meltdowns. In case you missed it, Williams, the defending champion, was losing to Kim Clijsters. On a crucial point in the second set, a lineswoman called a foot fault on Serena's second serve.
Foot fault, and that gives Kim Clijsters two match points.
Serena Williams lost it. She went over to the lineswoman, shook her racket at her, took a ball and verbally threatened her with it. A penalty point cost her the match, and she was fined $10,000. NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look at what else this might have cost her.
It certainly cost Serena Williams the anger of fans when she walked off the court, defeated, not by another player, but by an official's call. For Richard Evans, who writes for Tennis Week, it was a sad sight, especially since Serena Williams is such a positive role model.
It's very sad, and I think what Serena said and the language she used is very disappointing, and I know she will be disappointed with herself.
Williams did look disappointed in the press conference just following the match, but many commentators jumped on the fact that she didn't seem all that remorseful. On Sunday, the day after the match, she issued a statement acknowledging that she handled the situation poorly. It wasn't until today that she apologized to the lineswoman, to Kim Clijsters, and to her own fans.
Let's face it, abuse of an umpire is just about the cardinal sin in any sport.
Sally Jenkins is a sports writer for The Washington Post. She says one reason there's been such a vehement reaction to Serena Williams' outburst is because tennis seems like such a genteel sport.
I mean, I've seen far worse on NBA courts. I mean, my gosh. It's funny because tennis is such a hushed sport, and, it's a culture of silence. And stillness, in a way, between the points. And so when you do have an explosion like that, it just seems louder somehow.
But Sally Jenkins does not think this will have a negative impact on Serena Williams' career.
It's a black eye. She'll put a beefsteak on it, and the swelling will go down in about a week.
Maybe not even that long. Today, she and her doubles partner and sister Venus Williams won the U.S. Open women's doubles. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In April of 2004, Pat Tillman died on a treeless hillside in Afghanistan as he crouched behind some low boulders. The former NFL star turned Army Ranger was heard screaming, "What are you shooting at? I'm Pat Tillman." We now know he was killed in a barrage of friendly fire, but it took more than a month for the Army to acknowledge that fact. The story of Pat Tillman's life and the cover-up of how he died are told in a new book by John Krakauer, the author of Into Thin Air and Into the Wild. On that day in 2004, Pat Tillman's platoon was split in two. He was in the first convoy, which drove through a deep, narrow canyon. His younger brother, Kevin, was following behind in the second convoy when they were ambushed.
It was like Star Wars, one of the soldiers said. It was just all these tracer rounds, all these bullets flying, RPGs, mortars. And Pat's group looked back and immediately realized that the other half of the platoon was being attacked.
Being attacked by Afghan fighters.
That's right, by tribal insurgents working for the Taliban.
You describe Pat Tillman here. He knows his brother is back behind him. They're getting fired on. He sprints out. He apparently says to his fellow Ranger, "Let's go help our boys."
That's right. And you have to know, Pat and Kevin, the two brothers, were extremely close. I mean, this is a tight family all the way around. But Pat and Kevin, as one soldier put it, were joined at the hip.
Describe what happens when the back half of the platoon comes out of the canyon and start firing on the position where Pat Tillman is up on the hill. What happened? What were they thinking?
When they exited the canyon, they paused for maybe 30 seconds. By this point, Pat was in the boulders right above them. And Pat and another young private with him named Brian O'Neill reported later that, you know, they were shooting at us at first, but it seemed like no big deal. Then there was this lull. And then all of a sudden, when they got back in their Humvee and started moving, the area where Pat and O'Neill were just got hammered, just sprayed by this furious fusillade of everything, you know, all kinds of machine guns. What had happened was that with Tillman and O'Neill was an Afghan militia fighter named Syed Farhad. He had been firing suppressive fire up on the opposite canyon wall to prevent the enemy, if there were any left, from shooting down at the second half. The leader of this particular Humvee, out of the corner of his eye, he saw muzzle flashes. He saw that they were coming from a bearded guy with an AK-47. He testified that the guy had on an American uniform. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the panic of the moment, he reflexively put the guy in the sights of his M4 and put 7 rounds into his chest.
And he thought the Afghan was looking at him and firing at him.
He thought the Afghan was the enemy. What then happened is that all the other soldiers in that Humvee started firing their machine guns and M4s at that same place because they're trained to shoot where their team leader shoots. They're also trained, though, to identify their targets, positively identify your targets. None of them did that. Actually, the driver of that Humvee looked up and saw that they were Americans. He realized, wait, those are our guys. He yelled and tried to get people to stop, but he was a split second too late.
The Rangers who were on that hill knew immediately that this was friendly fire. There was no question. But the story, obviously, we know now, that emerged from the Pentagon was very different right away.
Yeah, and it's not just the soldiers on the ground who were there knew it was friendly fire. People from headquarters started arriving within a few hours. And every one of them, including the lieutenant colonel who was in charge of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, all of them immediately understood that it was friendly fire and acknowledged as much. I mean, it's not like anyone ever doubted it. And yet, within hours, certainly, and probably less, the Ranger Regiment and officers, high-ranking officers back in the States, were conspiring to cover this up. There's no other way to put it. The Army to this day denies it, but it defies belief. They immediately, by sworn testimony, started putting in a recommendation for a Silver Star Medal. That never happens, especially if you know that the soldier in question was killed by friendly fire. And then they did this astonishing series of things that puts a lie to their expressed, you know, desire to tell the truth. They burned, like when a soldier is killed in combat, you should put, you know, his uniform, his weapon, everything, anything that can be considered forensic evidence should be sent back to the States with the body so the medical examiners can determine the cause of death. In the case of Tillman, none of that happened. His uniform was burned. His body armor was burned. His weapon disappeared. His helmet disappeared. Part of his brain that was found on the ground disappeared. The Army intentionally lied to the medical examiners. They knowingly, deliberately lied and said he was killed by the Taliban, which really perplexed the guys who did the autopsy. They just broke regulation after regulation. They admonished Pat's platoon mates not to tell a soul. About the only person in the platoon by the first or second day who didn't know it was friendly fire was Pat's brother, Kevin, because everyone was told, don't tell Kevin what happened. They sent one of Pat and Kevin's best friend, this young guy named Russell Bear, to fly back to the States with Kevin and the body. And Russell Bear was ordered not to tell Kevin anything about what happened. In no uncertain terms, he was told he would be severely punished if he did. So he hardly said a word to Kevin on the flight back. But then during the memorial service, you know, he was invited by the parents afterwards to come to their home, and Bear was forced to lie to the mother to her face after handing her this flag that had been folded over Pat's casket. And he was so upset by having to lie to Pat's mother that Russell Bear went AWOL.
John Krakauer, there have been so many investigations now of how Pat Tillman died. There was congressional inquiry. Pat Tillman's mother wrote her own book. How did you deal with everything that was known already? How did you come to terms with trying to make something new or discover something new in this story?
Well, even to this day, there's a lot that isn't known. I interviewed members of Pat's platoon who had not been interviewed before, and that was invaluable. I actually learned a lot that hasn't been known until now. So, you know, it's not like I felt like the story had been fully told. It still hasn't been fully told. I mean, you know, the commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, who I think is probably the best man for the job, nevertheless, he was as deeply involved in the cover-up as anyone. You know, he signed off on what he knew was a falsified recommendation for a Silver Star. He apologized for that, but he hasn't come clean about much else. He hasn't revealed his involvement or who he spoke to or when he knew or if when Rumsfeld knew. I mean, so it's not like we know everything. We still don't.
John Krakauer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Krakauer. His book is titled Where Men Win Glory, The Odyssey of Pat Tillman. At his confirmation hearing earlier this year, General McChrystal acknowledged that the Army had failed the Tillman family. I was a part of that, he said, and I apologize for it. But McChrystal also said he didn't see any activities by anyone to deceive and that Pat Tillman absolutely earned the Silver Star.
And there's still more football tech news. I'm joined, as we generally are for All Tech Considered, by Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. Hello, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Great to be here.
And, you know, we heard recently about a potential rise in NFL blackout days this season. That's when a local TV broadcast of a game is blocked because the game didn't sell out. And I guess the NFL has since come up with a compromise.
Right. Last week, the NFL said they will give access to those games via tape delay. About 8 to 11 hours after the initial kickoff, they will be streaming those games on NFL.com. So if you are in an area where the football game has been blocked out, you can get to it online, just not live.
Now, how does the blackout apply to those fancy football packages on cable or on DirecTV, satellite TV? Could you get around the blackout that way?
No, actually, you know, on the NFL Network and the NFL Sunday Ticket on, say, DirecTV, those blackout rules still apply. It seems like the compromise is a bit of a signal that the NFL might be loosening up those restrictions a bit, but there's definitely some big games coming up this season that will probably still be affected by the blackout.
Omar, let's move on to some personal technology news. As you know, I've been a radio guy all my working life, and I understand there are many ways of listening to radio without a radio. But boy, for me, the big high-tech news was that in the new Nano iPod, the big new high-tech feature is, along with a video camera and this tiny thing, an FM radio.
Yeah, so some would say the video camera was the bigger deal, but yeah, FM radio is very nice to have in the iPod Nano. Apple announced last week that the iPod Nano, the very diminutive, colorful iPod, is going to have FM capabilities. It will also have a buffer where you can pause live radio for up to 15 minutes. An FM tuner in an MP3 player is nothing new. We've seen that in the Microsoft Zune, the Sony Walkman digital one, the SanDisk Sansa have all had FM radios for years now. And, you know, what's interesting is Microsoft's Zune has a new HD version coming out tomorrow that will have HD radio.
Hybrid digital radio.
It seems like the latest is this older technology and Apple finally acknowledging that some people might want to be listening to a live FM broadcast.
So maybe we do have a future.
I hope so.
We won't get rash about it. Right? Kurt Cobain, the late lead singer of Nirvana, is in the news. The newest version, I gather, of the video game Guitar Hero includes a likeness of Kurt Cobain, and he's singing Nirvana songs. But like other Guitar Hero avatars, he can also sing other people's songs.
Right. In the game, there's a career mode where you can unlock Kurt Cobain as what's called a playable character. That means you can play as him in the game. And where the controversy stems from is that, you know, we're all used to seeing videos of Kurt Cobain playing Nirvana songs, but he's also singing a Billy Idol song, Dancing With Myself. And you know, here's another song you wouldn't expect to hear Kurt Cobain singing. You Give Love a Bad Name by Bon Jovi, one song that probably never made it on the Nirvana playlist on tour. So it's a bit jarring to see Cobain in the green sweater on stage mouthing those words. You're actually hearing Bon Jovi's voice.
So who's complaining?
Well, the other members of Nirvana, Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl, have said publicly that they're not thrilled about this. But the person who's most furious is the widow and executor of the Kurt Cobain estate, Courtney Love, who on Twitter, among other places, has been very vocal, very angry about how he's being used in the game. Now, Activision, the company behind the game, says that they had her full cooperation in putting him in the game. They had an agreement with her. I think where the disagreement was how he would be used in the game, whether he'd be only singing Nirvana songs or, as we see in this video, whether he'd be playing other people's songs that you would never associate with Kurt Cobain.
Any other avatars creating troubles here, the new Guitar Hero?
You know, the one I'm not hearing about is Johnny Cash in the game, and there's actually a video floating around of five Johnny Cash characters on stage at the same time playing a Public Enemy song called Bring the Noise. So no outcry over that.
Okay. Thank you, Omar.
Thanks very much. And we will be posting both videos on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
A must-see. Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered.
How low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one. 5-4 set free.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Blah.
And I'm Robert Siegel. First this hour, some striking results from a survey of how doctors view the healthcare overhaul. At a time when support for the so-called public option is dwindling, a large majority of doctors say there should be a public option. NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
Two researchers from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York conducted a random survey, by mail and by phone, of more than 2,100 doctors. They collected the results from June right up to early September. Dr. Salome Kehani says what she found shows that the majority of physicians support a public option.
Nearly three-quarters of physicians supported some form of a public option, either alone or in combination with private insurance options.
Most doctors, 63%, say they favor giving patients a choice that would include both public and private insurance. That's the position of President Obama and of many congressional Democrats. In addition, another 10% of doctors say they favor a public option only. They'd like to see a single-payer healthcare system. The two groups together add up to 73%. When the American public is polled, anywhere from 50 to 70% favor a public option. So that means when compared to their patients, doctors are bigger supporters of a public option.
Oh, we even saw that support being the same whether physicians lived in rural areas or metropolitan areas.
Dr. Alex Fetterman, he's also an internist and researcher at Mount Sinai, is the study's co-author.
Whether they lived in southern regions of the United States or traditionally liberal parts of the country.
We found that physicians, regardless whether they were salaried or they were practice owners, regardless of whether they were specialists or primary care providers, or regardless of where they lived, the support for the public option was broad and widespread.
Kehani says doctors already have experience with government-run health care, with Medicare. And she says the survey shows, overall, they like it.
We've heard a lot about how the government is standing in between patients and their physician. And what we can see is that physicians support Medicare. So I think physicians have sort of signaled that a public option that's similar in design to Medicare would be a good way of ensuring patients get the care that they need.
The survey was published online today by the New England Journal of Medicine. And it was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a healthcare research organization that favors health reform. The survey even found widespread support for a public option among doctors who are members of the American Medical Association, a group that's opposed to it. The AMA fears a public option eventually could lead to government putting more limits on doctors' fees. Kehani and Fetterman belong to another, smaller group, the National Physicians Alliance. It supports a public option, and Kehani has spoken publicly about her own support for a public option. Dr. James Rohack is president of the AMA. He says it's hard to know for sure what doctors mean when they speak about a public option.
Because when I say public option or you say public option, it means different things to different people. It's kind of like the Rorschach ink blot test. When you look at it, to some people it means one thing, to other people it means the other thing.
The AMA's own position on a health overhaul has, at times, been hard to pinpoint. In July, it praised the bill that came out of the House of Representatives. That bill included a public option, but the AMA made it clear that what it really liked was that it eliminated cuts in doctors' fees from Medicare.
And so I think that's why we have to be very clear about what does the AMA articulate for. It's to make sure that everyone has coverage that's affordable, that's portable, and that is quality. That is, it covers the things you need to cover because you've got a medical condition or developed a medical illness.
Politicians in Washington turn to the AMA for support and guidance, even though fewer than a third of doctors belong to the lobbying group. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And we should note that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which funded the doctor survey, also supports NPR. Finally this hour, a lighter critter story, New York City's cricket crawl. We heard about it earlier this month from an entomologist and organizer of the event. The idea was ordinary citizens go out at night all over the city, all over the New York metropolitan area, searching for species of crickets and katydids. Well, NPR's Margot Adler went out on the cricket crawl on Saturday night, and here is what she found and heard.
The cricket crawl was partly about getting people outside, creating a citizen scientist model that could be used for many surveys, but it was also about finding the classic katydid, the common true katydid, found all over. But 90 years ago, a naturalist said they were no longer in New York City. A week before the crawl, I spent an evening with Marie Wynn, author of several books about nature in the city. She had become obsessed.
I feel that I stand at my window on Riverside Drive and 91st Street every night and hear these katydids.
And there they were. But like most of us, she wasn't sure. Perhaps it was the lesser angle-wing, which has a somewhat similar sound. After all, most of us aren't experts on crickets. Even Marie Wynn says she's sort of a second grader.
I can pretty well tell you, oh, that's a chestnut-sided warbler, and that is a prothonotary warbler. But here, I've just started learning these things.
And yet, she says, it's sort of like the orchestra. It's only when you start playing the clarinet that you hear it all the time. A week later, it's time for the crawl. In front of the Museum of Natural History, Lou Sorkin says there isn't really a strategy for finding these crickets and katydids.
You just have to stop, listen, continue a bit, stop and listen, and see what you hear.
But that's not as simple as it seems for most humans. I hear cicadas every August, but never realized until a week ago that they're day singers and katydids are the night singers, except on those hot summer evenings where they mix for a few hours. The katydids are high in the trees, but you can get close to some crickets.
See this cricket here?
Now it stopped chirping now that you shine the light on it, right?
Yeah.
How does it make its call?
By the wings moving.
The wings moving?
Across each other.
Back at the American Museum of Natural History, data is coming in to Team Cricket.
This is Dave Jenkins, Carla Jenkins. The time is 8:39, and we are...
in our backyard.
That's Milford, New Jersey. And we heard the field cricket, the jumping bush cricket, and the...
lesser angle wing.
People could go on the website and learn the sounds of seven target species, but out in Central Park, naturalist Sam Droege, one of the coordinators of the crawl, showed me it's not so easy.
What's calling now?
Field cricket?
Nope.
Jumping bush cricket?
Very good. You're making to cricket level two now.
In the end, people called from about 350 different sites with reports on all seven species. By the way, Sam Droege and Lou Sorkin say the sounds outside Marie Wynn's apartment are those of common true katydids. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Finally, I want to talk about that outburst by South Carolina Representative Joe Wilson at the president's joint address to Congress last week. The congressman shouted, "You lie," when the president was talking about health care. Even though Wilson called the president to apologize, Democrats say the congressman should return to the scene of the crime, as it were, and apologize publicly on the House floor. Wilson says he most certainly will not. Perhaps he is emboldened by the congratulations flowing into his office from people who applaud him for speaking his mind. Whatever. I wonder if these same people will be lining up now to support every smart-mouthed kid who disrupts a student assembly or their own child's class because he doesn't like the lesson plan. Will they start a defense fund for the kid who wants to wear his legalized weed T-shirt at graduation? Or how about all the people barred and evicted from so-called public events in recent years because they didn't agree with President Bush's policies? Amazing how the rules of courtesy fly out the window when, well, when exactly do they? When exactly is it okay to be rude? When the rude one is someone you like, or the target is someone you don't? Now, some conservatives argue Democrats did the same thing during President Bush's term, but that dog won't hunt. While it is true that booing and cheering are now and have always been heard in the House chamber, no one can point to a Democrat who, during a public address, verbally attacked or personally vilified President Bush during a public occasion, despite intense disagreement over his policies, especially on national defense. It did not happen. It is all the more amazing to me that the people defending this conduct no doubt consider themselves conservatives, and even, as one reporter wrote of Mr. Wilson, a gentleman, and a Southern gentleman at that. It is worth remembering that this so-called Southern gentleman is the same person who also attacked the biracial Essie Mae Washington Williams as participating in a smear for finally revealing that South Carolina's former white segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond was her father. It was a fact. not a smear. Mr. Wilson had more reason to know the truth than most, having been a Thurman aide. And this gentlemanly Mr. Wilson is the same person who, in a 2002 appearance on C-SPAN, attacked his fellow Congressman Bob Filner as a man with a, quote, hatred of America. This would be the same Bob Filner who loved his country enough, or at least its citizens enough, to put his body on the line as a freedom rider and spent 2 months in a Mississippi jail as a result. Can I just tell you, there are always those who will argue that civility is a distraction from the so-called real issues, not important. But whoever says that is just saying the issue at hand is not important to him or her. But that issue becomes very important when we are the targets of disrespect. Thankfully, we've moved beyond a time when adults used to duel over a lack of respect, but one can still pick up a newspaper in an urban area on any given week and find stories about teenagers who are willing to shoot each other over it. And at the end of the day, what is civility but according others the respect of their office or even their humanity? Withholding that courtesy is a way of denying the other person is who he is. Wilson's outburst, so far outside the norms of the institution, was really just a way of saying that President Obama did not deserve the respect of his office. And why would he not? The New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd wrote yesterday that she had reluctantly concluded that race is a part of it, that there are those who just cannot believe that this black man is their president. If that isn't the message Wilson wants to leave us with, then it seems to me he should come out and say so. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.